When I got this book, it brought me back to the like group house that my college boyfriend was living in 2000, which was my sophomore year. And it was the sophomore year of college. And it was the first time that I'd ever been able to vote in an election. And I remember watching that really crappy little TV and us all watching the news about Bush v. Gore and being like, okay, this is the first time I've ever been able to vote. And I also like my father, well, he's retired now, but is an attorney. And I think I grew up with a sense of like, oh, like the legal system has some sort of relationship to justice and fairness. And I remember just being like, oh, it had been hyped up for me, you know, and I did my little absentee ballot for the first time. And, you know, just the sort of realization, you know, which now I look back and I cringe because I was like, okay, I was like 18 or 19. I was old enough to realize more than I did, I suppose, about the political process. But I just remember this feeling of like, George W. Bush is going to be president and he's an idiot and like a malignant idiot, and nothing that I had been told was true. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I still remember like my heart sinking. Yeah. It sounds banal now when I think about it, but it's like, it's really like in my memory as a time where I was just like, those things that you thought about institutions are simply not the case.
I have an infantile example. I remember when my parents
very were appropriate.
Yeah, I forget what year this is. Sorry, I'm just a little fatigued on numbers. But
also,
infantile. Yeah, but I was a kid still, and my parents were going to vote. I guess. Well, I don't even remember. I remember being very enthusiastic for Dukakis. And I think it had something to do with the consonants in the name. I think it's, you know, it's got that lovely sort of Greek thing. I don't know if I even knew what he looked like, et cetera. But I remember my parents going out to vote. My dad, very distinct 1980s suit. My mother with a trench coat with the shoulder pads. And I remember like they had to go out to vote. It was a big thing. Like they had, instead of staying for home for dinner, they had to go to vote. And I remember like Dukakis. And then I remember the next day feeling some sort of loss, but I have no idea what it was or how to look at it. So that was like my earliest like sort of electoral political disappointment. Mm-hmm. More practically, I think like the ones that really got me, setting aside like experiences of like horror at how the repressive state operates, you know what I mean? Like in the spirit of your book, I'm not taking political disappointment to be like, for example, like at least in my case, like the murder of Amadou Diallo, which really troubled me as a child, but I didn't even really politicize it so much as understand it as like evil and like that institutions didn't mean anything. But in an adult mode, I think it would be Obama. And it's hard for me to locate when in the Obama administration that happened. I know I was somewhat cynical going into it in many ways, but I do remember also like these experiences of enthusiasm and like almost triumph, particularly because the previous 4 years have been so rough. But like, if you'll forgive me, this is a little cringe, but I feel like I can lean into it. Like I remember on the night of he won the election, I was living in Atlanta at the time, and I was in a car with some friends, and we were driving right after it was dark. The election results have been announced, and the city was just popping off. And Young Jeezy's My President came on, and they had mixed it with the Hail to the Chief anthem. And the whole city was turned out, right? This is like right between like the Claremont and like downtown. And it felt wonderful, right? Yeah. I know it was cringe even at the time and silly, but it was like, this at least is something that is different. And there seems to be collective effervescence, and there have been so little of that.
Yeah.
And then I don't even know. It was certainly in the ongoing conduct in the war in Iraq, Afghanistan. I think like probably also like the moment he had that cop over for lemonade or beers or whatever, like at some point it became clear that something I had been hoping for had not arrived. And then there were subsequent betrayals on things that, you know, the previous 8 years had taught me to be sensitized to. And then it just felt, I don't know. The tellus of that for me is the, well, we tortured some folks which as a phrase is like an epithet to that whole thing, right? Where if earlier there was like this collective effervescence and we're like, here's somewhere, you know, albeit cringe and problematic in its own right, elevation of this guy. Now he's like shifting responsibility down onto us. It felt like, yeah, disappointment. And then I got tossed a shovel.
So my personal one, I mean, I really resonate, Pat, with what you're saying about, for me, the sort of like moment of hope that gets disappointed in the Obama years is not even the hope of election night, but the hope that was occurring when I was canvassing for him in Columbus, Ohio, and feeling that all of these methodologies and approaches and political philosophies from community organizing were like now had a transom into electoral politics. So I had had, for whatever reason, I had had very little faith in electoral politics at any point in my adult life.
Yeah,
I was always really focused on how to build power for movements. And that's one reason why, I guess the main reason why the disappointment that I think of as like my real inaugural, like gut level disappointment was the one around 2000, not with what happens in the Supreme Court, but what happens in Philadelphia with the crackdown on the protests against the convention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I had been involved with organizing legal support for the protests and the demonstrations. And that was coming off of the heels of the Alter Globalization movement and the WTO protests, which I had been present for, and the IMF protests, which people in my community had been organizing around. Mm-hmm. And it felt like that kind of movement building was going to continue growing in inclusiveness and power and analysis. And the boot of the law just coming down so brutally, in many cases, literally, yeah, on the heads of demonstrators who were not only arrested and jailed for weeks in the aftermath of the protests, but also who had their puppet-making warehouse raided and the puppets destroyed, or people in my community in Philly were imprisoned on $1 million bails based on made up attacks on police, which were later not upheld in court, but operated to really chill that kind of organizing. That was where the limitations of what you could do against a state power that was bent on shutting you up,
yeah,
really were. And it was really devastating for me and for, you know, for a lot of the people in my community in Philly at the time. And so when the Obama campaign came up and seemed to be this marvelous scene of amplifying grassroots community organizing energies and approaches and catchphrases like "Si se puede," all of these things that were familiar to me from picket lines throughout my adult life. It was so exciting to see that on a national electoral stage that I did think, oh, maybe there will be a sort of fusion and it won't be like absolute liberation through the right candidate, but it'll be a different kind of political world.
Yeah.
And of course, it was the same political world as it had been. So I began writing this book about political disappointment during the Obama years, seeing this disappointment, seeing people around me reeling from it and thinking, I've been here before. And I've been here before. This feels incredibly familiar to me. And what's more, there are things that I've read over the course of the 20th century in which I also recognize this feeling of letdown that everyone around me on the left is expressing at this point. And I want to think about the long history of what it's like to not get something that really seemed to be just within reach.
Listening to Ordinary Unhappiness, a podcast about psychoanalysis, politics, pop culture, and the ways we suffer now. I'm Abby Kluchin.
I'm Patrick Blanchfield.
And today I am delighted to introduce Sarah Marcus, our guest today. Sarah is assistant professor of English at the University of Notre Dame, where she is also affiliated with the Gender Studies program and the Initiative on Race and Resilience. Her latest book, which is what we're going to be talking about today, Political Disappointment, A Cultural History from Reconstruction to the AIDS Crisis, was published this past May by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Sarah's previous book, The Punk Feminist History, Girls to the Front, The True Story of the Riot Girl Revolution, was a finalist for the National Award for Arts Writing and has been translated into Spanish, Portuguese, and Polish. Her writing has appeared in American Literary History, American Literature, Art Forum, Book Forum, Dissent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, The New Republic, Public Books, and elsewhere. Sarah, welcome. We're so glad you're here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So let's get into it. Your book deploys a very specific conception of political disappointment to think generatively about the history of 20th century social organizing, cultural and artistic productions like music and novels, and more. But what most immediately struck us, and will, I think, strike listeners, is right off in the introduction where you define political disappointment in, you know, what I kind of think of as sort of psychoanalytic terms as untimely desire, a longing for fundamental change that outlasts a historical moment when it might have been fulfilled. And this rings so many notes for an analytically attuned ear. And you go on to describe political disappointment in dialogue with Freud and with Melanie Klein in relation to questions of loss, mourning, recognition, and desire. And so political disappointment thus comes to describe a particular structure, a set of relations to an object that's constituted and unfolding in time and functioning as what you call the work of disappointment. Can you walk us through how disappointment works and how disappointment stands in relation to notions like disillusionment or hope or, you know, even despair?
Great. Yes. It's true. There's a more colloquial sense of disappointment, which is the way in which anybody I was talking to during the years that I was writing this book would immediately say, oh yes, political disappointment. I have some of that. And proceed to tell me about the things that they were disappointed about. And I very quickly learned not to be like, well, that thing that you're describing, it's not exactly disappointment according to my model. Instead, I learned instead to listen and to think about all the different ways that people experience themselves as being disappointed. Whereas in my intellectual work, as I was working out this concept, it did feel important to me primarily, in the first place, to distinguish disappointment from disillusionment.
Yeah.
Because I was writing in conversation with and in a way against a mid-century American tradition of like post-communist disillusionment,
yeah,
where people recognize the error of their ways and their experience of a failed movement is one of total disavowal and even of then going on to kind of retrospectively revise the ideals they had held as having been misguided or not worth holding. Okay, so that's a clearly delineated tradition in American liberal thought or from the mid-century onward. And what hadn't been studied or mapped out quite as well was all the other people who had lived through ends or defeats of political movements without then going back and saying, well, I never should have believed that in the first place, right? So disillusionment then is a circumstance in which you decide that you had been wrong before to want the thing you'd wanted, and now you've had an education and you're wanting something different altogether. Disappointment is more a situation of going on wanting the thing that isn't available anymore, and not being ready to say, like, I never should have wanted it in the first place. And that was what I saw going on all around me in the early years of the 21st century. It was certainly what I was experiencing In the aftermath of having been pretty involved in some social movements that hadn't panned out the way that I thought, and trying to figure out what were new ways of remaining attached to the ideals and, you know, visions for society that I had held already that I wasn't ready to let go of. And at the same time, the old ways of engaging and working toward those seemed no longer to be effective or well suited to what I understood to be the way things worked. So that's this principal distinction between disillusionment and disappointment. And very often people would talk to me, oh, yes, I have a disappointment. And I would think in my head, that's kind of more disillusionment. But the fact that it both operates as a sort of colloquialism that people think they already know about, but also as something when you think about it more closely, has really a really specific shape and set of ways it unfolds, while at the same time being less specific than the like particular affects of grief or despair or melancholia, these things where like even the affective flavor, the mood of it seems preset. Disappointment, I noticed, could go in a bunch of different ways, from anger to resignation to even a sort of renewed, I'm trying to avoid saying hope and instead say like a renewed determination toward continued engagement in some way.
So what I take you to be saying is that disappointment for you and like the work of disappointment is first and foremost perhaps legible as a dynamic process. Well, that involves particularly an ongoing relationality to an object. And I'm thinking about this sort of in contrast to the template we alluded to earlier, vis-a-vis disappointment, the tales of I like Whitaker Chambers or like some of these mid-20th century people who are like, I was a Marxist, but then, or these neocon types.
Right. Where there's a recanting.
Yeah. There's kind of this rejection, Oedipal or otherwise. And and here we have a more integrated or kind of, I hesitate to use the word realist because in some ways, like, well, I feel I'll call it realistic, but at least as far as like the reality principle is there, but part of my hesitancy is because so many of those other people describe themselves as being realists, right? One way disillusionment so often is expressed is in the language of being realist, right. Realistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and compromise.
Yeah.
Right.
Maturity. Right. There's a whole developmental kind of narrative to this too, that's really overdetermined, it seems. But what I loved about this definition and what I found so kind of bad is that in that ongoing relationality, it suggests creativity and productivity, even if it's hesitant, even if it is conditioned by disappointment. And the way you phrase this is as like a, your concern being with ongoing attachments to objects or ideals that, although disappointing, might not necessarily be responsible for a further decay of possibilities for flourishing. It's like the object exists. It doesn't have to be like stamped out the way like the you know, reformed communist member of HUAC has to eliminate communists or something. Like it's still there. It still exists. You're disappointed. You have a more realistic assessment of the object and you can integrate or work with it.
And it also, and this is something that you bring up in the book, it's not the same. Political disappointment, it seems to me, is really generative because even though it's about being thwarted, you know, it involves desire that goes unfulfilled in really painful ways, you know, personally, politically. I mean, I can't even make that distinction here in some way, right? That's part of what political disappointment, the work of that phrase does, is like refuses those distinctions. But it's still not quite as like cruel as like Lauren Berlant's cruel optimism. And do you mind if I ask you to just say a little bit about how you're thinking with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Lauren Berlant's work was so crucial to me thinking out these thoughts, and Cruel Optimism in particular was a huge influence on this project. What distinguishes the things that I'm writing about from the objects and examples in Berlant's book is that I'm really trying to think about the instances that Berlant's framework doesn't cover. Berlant never says, like, all ongoing engagements with objects that aren't actually producing a good life are ipso facto cruel and going to get in the way of any approach to the good life you had hoped for. Just some of them are. Right. And I will write about, and so Berlant writes about those very persuasively, richly. But I had this set of objects in mind and really this sort of 20th century cultural tradition that was knocking around in my brain for a lot of years, where I saw something else going on and where there was an ongoing attachment that was imagined and understood and experienced, not as an obstacle to further flourishing, not as a guarantee of it either, but some other thing that needed to be thought through and mapped out.
Yeah, because, you know, the answer, it doesn't seem to be like turn away from those objects, weaken mm-hmm. that attachment, right? In this sort of intractable way that, you know, I guess I think of when I think of cruel optimism. Mm-hmm.
It seems salient and important here to unpack how the work of disappointment you are describing here in the political realm has implications for not just the trajectories of disillusionment that we've talked about earlier, but also for the particular type of letdown or lack of letdown that comes with utopian projects, leftist or otherwise, and which are, you know, of course, an object of preoccupation on the left in various different ways. Could you talk a little bit about that and the way in which like the utopian object is a little bit different from the object that we're talking about here?
Happy to. The structure of utopian yearning, especially as we get in Munoz and in the Bloch that is filtered through Munoz, which I think isn't all Bloch, is really invested in a continuing orientation toward a horizon that hasn't arrived, right? Like the not yet is this object of like great investment for the kind of utopian thinking that that comes up in Munoz and in a lot of other thinkers who are influenced by him. This kind of investment in a continually available, always out there utopian horizon, and the investment that often comes along with it of like disconnecting from concrete material and historical conditions as, you know, being sort of the hobgoblin of someone who can't see the continuing availability of the revolution or whatever out there somewhere, strikes me as something quite different from the work that disappointment does. It's a real kind of deferral and in some way refusal of an acknowledgement of non-fulfillment that I don't think is terribly sustainable over the long term, because at some point the actual lived experience of non-fulfillment catches up with and will overtake whatever like principled commitment one might have to refusing to admit that non-arrival of the thing that you had wanted. And I'm not even saying that, and you'll notice that I didn't say admit defeat right there. And I really do carefully avoid talking about defeat, because a lot of my point is that non-fulfillment, letting that in, doesn't necessarily seed the question of like how permanent a defeat is. But if there's this like constant manic drive to leap over whatever non-fulfillment is available in the present and keep an eye focused instead on some wide open future, that deprives us of the ability to get to the very generativity and the very productivity and creativity that can only come about with the recognition of not getting the thing you wanted, the thing you thought you would get.
I think this is really, really powerful in its implications for thinking through a lot of things, both clinically and otherwise, but also I think politically too, right? And just to crudely kind of paraphrase back to you what I hear you're saying and hopefully doing it justice, I think about the ways in which even if people aren't familiar with Bloch or with any particular revolutionary tradition, the idea of revolutionaries, quintessentially communist ones, but also sort of other figures, being driven or like aflame with a vision of an entirely transformed social order that's just around the corner, right? Mm-hmm. If the king is overthrown, if the system is overthrown, right? If we finally catch the man and kill him, whatever it is. Or even on a higher level, this sort of inevitabilities of workers' revolution as sort of a de-agentialized process, whatever it is. But the faith in this thing is a thing you can see and a thing that can arrive. Well, as you say in the book, that's a thing that can never be fulfilled on a structural level, which is to say, what I want to make clear that I think you're doing and what we're interested in doing is navigating the gap between a working heuristic of the reality principle, like some things may not be achievable, but also kind of orthogonal to that, some political sense of individual subjective agency that maybe we can change reality, and reality is actually kind of plastic, and so are we ourselves, right? So bracketing that, it does seem like what you're describing in the structure of the utopian is that the utopian can kind of like, by definition, never be disappointed because the thing is impossible. And in that way, I found myself, that clarified something for me about the phenomena specifically of, well, utopians who literally are never disappointed as like a functional matter. Mm-hmm. And I think here of like messianic predictions, yeah, or like cults, when mm-hmm. they like, it's a structure of attachment to, it's both an attachment to an object that's different than what's capable of disappointment, but also the object itself is different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you say here, I just want to read this one line because it's so lovely and returns us back now to this even more deepened concept of disappointment, is that the very impossibility of disappointment in utopian logic also forecloses the productivity that only comes with the acknowledgement of loss. Mm-hmm. Loss and the generativity it spurs is only possible when we permit ourselves to recognize our attachment to particular objects, actual or potential, objects that may vanish or fail to materialize as expected, leaving disappointment in their wake. This has helped me think about, I was teaching Andre Green actually literally yesterday on loss and like loss that's erased. And, you know, how do you know that you've lost a thing if you've never even known what the thing was? So you lose it. And I found this actually, the yeah. theory of loss that you've got here, even in the very, very tight way you lay it out.
Really early on. Yeah.
Yeah. And via the genealogy of Klein, and in particular, in addition to including some lovely lines about Klein, like that bit about like a persistent desire conditioned by loss, it's really, really good. And I think it could go in a lot of directions.
Thank you. And I'm so glad that the part where I just get into the Klein lands for you, because yeah. I had to push back a little bit to keep that in. My editor, whom I love, was like, can you really cut down these, whatever it is, 4 pages where you like lay out the psychoanalytic grounding and like the Klein and the Siegel and the Abraham and Torok, and the, you know, the communion of empty mouths. And I was like, I can't lose the communion of empty mouths.
No,
I cannot.
I don't think
like,
so.
I need all of this.
I think it's and really, yeah.
It's me. And I said, okay, I'll put it in its own section. People who don't want it, they can just skip to the next section. but to me, it was so important because, and the important thing to know about all that psychoanalytic theory stuff is that I read all of that after writing the rest of the book. Like after I arrived at my conception of disappointment, like from the objects that I read in the chapters. Yeah. It wasn't like I started with an idea and I went looking for it. I really went from the ground up with that. And I was so happy then to like go into the psychoanalytic literature mm-hmm. and be like, oh, and here they know it too. They saw it too. And they have these beautiful formulations about it. Just like this, especially that Abraham and Torok phrase of, you know, this isn't them, this is me paraphrasing, but sure. like to get from, I didn't get what I wanted to, I'm going to make symbols and language that communicate what it's like to not get that. And that is going to be how I connect with other people. And like, yeah, that's what my whole book is about. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they write about it as, a community of empty mouths because their idea of, you know, being Kleinians, they're writing about how the need to talk about not getting your thing only comes up when you're not getting the thing. And the thing as the baby is the mother's breast in your mouth. And so then your mouth is empty and you fill it with words, which is just, oh, and I realized on looking back at the book that I had cut a silly line I had written, but that you guys might like, which was just like, I think it was really in Proofs that I was like, no, Marcus, this is too jokey. But I was just like, who can deny that it's hard to talk with your mouth full?
That's hilarious. No, I'm honestly kind of floored to realize that, like, not that I would have thought that you would approach a text like to validate a set of theories, but that this is,
yeah,
like the material itself seemed so imminently psychoanalytic that mm-hmm. like, that's just an amazing testimony to the theory and to your reading and more. But the chapter that you do on voices and on the recognition of voices, just, I felt that line like haunting the whole thing somehow without even realizing that, and to know that that had come afterwards is just remarkable. Yeah. And I guess what I should say is that what I really wanted to tell you vis-a-vis the legs that I think that model has is that you deliver it tautly and I think entirely correctly in terms of the use of the theory. I was able to run with it and see it working in each and every chapter that happened. And it could presumably be applied to other objects too, very easily. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say that that's a rare thing. And I think you did an awesome job of that. So kudos. Yeah.
I need to give credit where credit is due in a certain way. It is true that I did not read the Kleinian theory and the Siegel and everything until after I'd written the chapters. But I should give credit where credit is due and say that probably some of how I approached the works in the chapters and approached finding my objects and analyzing them can't be separated from, you know, my experience in clinic with a Kleinian analyst. That's like the experiential piece that sort of like seeps in from the bottom up, but wasn't an explicit like part of the intellectual framework until late in the game.
Now that we have a sense of the specificity of what you mean by political disappointment, right? And have done a little bit of that work of disambiguating it, especially from disillusionment. Let's turn to some of the different, I guess we could say objects, but more specifically, movements, figures, and texts that you survey to the work that your book does of, and here I'm quoting you, tracking historical instances when people sensed possibility waxing and waning amid historical flux, in asking how people's political desires changed in such instances, and in noticing how the resulting disappointment shaped culture. Now I'm not quoting you anymore. Now I'm just talking. There are so many rich subjects here, and we're barely going to be able to scratch the surface, but we'd really like to start with W.E.B. Du Bois and his disappointment with progress. So can you tell us a little bit about Du Bois's experience and thinking of political disappointment?
Happy to do so. Du Bois comes up at the very beginning of the book because he actually writes about disappointment as something that is especially salient for the African-American community in the wake of the end of Reconstruction. And he says, whatever good came of those years of change, a shadow of a deep disappointment rests on Black Americans. And he then writes about sort of how that desire comes up and gets disappointed.
Yeah.
And he writes about how before emancipation, he writes, in song and exhortation swelled one refrain, liberty. So here you have this utopian object, this horizon that everybody agrees on. It's in song and exhortation. So it's across media, it's across different forms of sound and performance. And then he says the freedman has not yet found in freedom his promised land. So, right, the object arrives and it's not all it was cracked up to be. And at this point, the question of, well, what do we want? We got freedom and it isn't working out. It doesn't look like we thought it would. What do we do next? And he writes that a succession of other objects comes up. And, you know, do we fight next for the right to vote or for industrial training or for liberal education? And he writes, you know, are they all wrong? Are they all false? And instead he writes that each one helps to contribute to an overall goal. And he writes work, culture, liberty, all these we need, not singly, but together. Not successively, but together, each growing and aiding each. So I really took his account here toward the beginning of The Souls of Black Folk as a model for what happens to a desire that is disappointed. And one of the things is that it fragments into multiple partial objects of desire that, in order to be actionable, need to somehow be understood as as facets of the same thing. So you asked me about how Du Bois thinks about progress.
Yeah.
And in his essay in The Souls of Black Folk on the Meaning of Progress, he returns to a school in rural Tennessee where he had taught while he was in college. And it's a few years later, and the old rickety school has been transformed into a nicer, more modern school. And certain things on paper are better. And yet, this young woman that he was close with at the time when he was teaching there has died. Some people he talks with seem weighed down by misery in a way that's difficult to quantify. And so he shows up both as, at this point, a trained sociologist who's quantifying things, but at the same time as somebody who lived there and somebody with an artistic and literary understanding of the importance of individual experience. And he's trying to put these things next to each other and figure out how to calculate them. And he writes, how many heartfuls of sorrow shall balance a bushel of wheat? Right? How can you tell if this progress is better than what was before? Like, how do you measure that? And in that essay, he doesn't answer it. He just says, thus sadly musing, I traveled back north in the Jim Crow car. But the question comes back again at the end of The Souls of Black Folk in his essay about the sorrow songs, where he asks a similar way. He says, you know, in these songs, I hear how very often the minor cadences of sadness turn into calm hope toward the ends of the song. Is such a hope justified? Do the sorrow songs sing true? And then he goes on a kind of journey of like world human intellectual history to try and come up with an answer for that. But in the end, the best that he can do is to turn instead to music as the answer. And this is where at almost the very end of the book, he plops in a whole verse of musical transcription on a song, Let Us Cheer the Weary Traveler. And it's the first full song. There are transcriptions throughout The Souls of Black Folk, but this is the first one that's a full verse. It's the first one that's both treble and bass clef. It's the first one with a full four-part chorus. It's the first one that unites words and music, since so many of the transcriptions that head up each chapter are just musical transcription without the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so this is where we see the not singly but together, not successively but together, each growing and aiding each. He's trying to really paint out a polyphony. And rather than sort of arrive at it intellectually through argumentation, he puts it there more experientially and sonically to close out the book as there may not be an answer to whether the hope is justified or not. There is just, let us cheer the weary traveler along the heavenly way. You just keep going and you look for what gives you the strength to keep going. That's the best that you can do. And music is sort of, it would have, I think, been not as persuasive for him to just write that out, right? But instead he gives a whole page to the music of it. And you sort of feel that. And if you can read music, you kind of go through the song in your head. And then you're there with him at the end of the book.
Well, you're giving me a really beautiful segue to ask you a little bit more about the role of music in your book. And I should say, just for our listeners who have not yet bought your book, that, you know, some of the other chapters explore other instances of American political disappointment, from communists deprioritizing interracial worker organizing in the interwar era, to the split of Black power activists from the mainstream civil rights movement, to the tragedies and inertia of the AIDS era and beyond. And for reasons of time, we're not going to be able to get into all of this here. But I think we can spend some time talking about the role of music. And of course, you know, when I introduced you, I mentioned, and this is how I, you know, even before I met you in person, I knew you through your work on Riot Girl music. Like, clearly, like, it's not just the method of the book, but also the sensibility of it is so informed by your thinking musically. You're dealing also with audio archives, recorded journals, and soundscapes. So can you tell us a little bit about this, about what music appears in the book, how music can figure in the work of disappointment, and what such music can convey to us now. And perhaps we can also talk about the way that your book takes up, as Patrick alluded to earlier, the notion of voices and listening as a kind of orientation, although not in a not in an uncritical way, right? That was a lot.
Let me think about let me think about where to start. I can start by just giving a sense of what the sonic objects are in the book, so that your listeners can understand what the different sounds that resonate through the chapters are. I've already talked about Du Bois's transcriptions, or the transcriptions that Du Bois uses, rather, he didn't make them himself, of African-American spirituals, the Sorrow Songs, in The Souls of Black Folk. Also in that chapter, I look at the transcriptions made by a founding member of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, whose name was Ella Shepherd, and whose transcriptions appear in the Fisk Jubilee Singers songbooks uncredited, but they were published as standalone sheet music editions by a music publisher in Cincinnati, which is how I found that, that the small handful of songs had been her explicit transcription work. And so that was very interesting, because you'll find a lot of conversations about sort of the maybe a like a colonialist or extractivist operation that is the transcription of Black music by outsiders, and the different ways that white redactors and editors would speak in variously, I don't want to say problematic, like an undergrad, but like, you know, in variously like troubling and inaccurate and distorting ways about the music that they're writing. But then here we have an example of somebody who's in the group and who was transcribing the work, the songs that she and her fellow group members were bringing from remembering hearing them from in their communities and in their families. So I found the specific writerly work that Ella Shepherd was doing to be super interesting. Anyway, that's the first chapter. The main sounds in the second chapter are the sounds of the folk singer Hughie Leadbetter, also known as Leadbelly, and his work songs such as Take This Hammer, which is his most famous one, and a few others, in which at a certain point in his career, he began to add this kind of vocalized sound of labor, this expressive like exhalation that sounded like ha, that would happen rhythmically in the song. I'm thinking about the moment at which he starts to add those to his songs, because I found early recordings in which it's not there. And then at a certain point, it shows up in the recordings and then becomes like this really like thematized and highlighted element of the songs by the time that he's working with musical collaborators in the early 40s.
Take this hammer, wow, and carry to the captain. Wow. Take this hammer, wow, and carry to the captain.
I loved it. I just want to tell you, I loved that so much.
You like, love that. I
love blues and I love old blues. And there's something about that, even as we've talked about like nonverbals and whatnot as being communicative, you know, in the context of transference and stuff, I had never thought about how one of the distinctive like ticks or like performance, like bits of Leadbelly himself actually could be legible as as standing in, not just for a hammer, but in terms of the logic of breath you use, which, you know, in the year 2024 is so overdetermined, but I just thought that was that sound, that like nonverbal, opened up like a Zen master's like Fats or something. Like it was like one of those, it was great. And your reading of it was lovely. I just wanted to, it was awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really glad that that was helpful for you. And that was also where the difficulty that everybody had in transcribing these sounds in collections of folk song in the decades leading up to Leadbelly's performances was where the whole idea of focusing in on transcription in the book began.
Oh, interesting.
And it was great because throughout working on the book, which began as a dissertation, and people would always ask me, as you would ask a graduate student working on a dissertation, oh, you've got your literature and you've got your music. Why these two things? How do they go together? And I'd be like, I'll get back to you on that. And transcription turned out to be the hinge that got it, that connected it all up and enabled it to be mobile, but really to justify the coexistence of these objects in the project and in the archive. And just to say, alongside the Lead Belly bits, I also write about the fiction of Tilly Olson, which it was only after writing about Lead Belly that then I went back to the Olson to tell me a riddle to see how many transcriptions of nonverbal bodily sounds are in that novella, mm-hmm. which is about a woman who's dying and she's singing these, you know, this utopian song and quoting this Victor Hugo speech about like the coming of peace in the 20th century. And all of these recitations are being interrupted by coughs and gurgles and gasps that Olson is writing out. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's really all happening here. Thinking about how the body sort of like insists on its presence within these like disappointed revolutionary utterances. Mm-hmm. A few other sounds, trying to move quickly, that come up later in the book include the literal question of like, how did the sound engineering go at these concerts, these feminist women's music concerts in the late 70s, when there was a tour called the Varied Voices of Black Women Tour that was put on by the lesbian feminist women's music label Olivia Records. And there was a whole kerfuffle in Boston with letters to the editor and articles about like, did the sound suck at these concerts? For me, as somebody who had, you know, been in bands playing in venues where the sound usually did suck for a lot of my 20s, I just found this an absolutely fascinating bit of archival gold. And that's also where I come to. So Patrick, to your question about like voice and how I talk about voice and listening as a, but not in a naive way. This is precisely where I look at the idea of like women's voices in the second wave feminist thought.
Right.
And what happens when the dream of just like these disembodied, like ideally communicating women's voices come up against like the reality of voice as an embodied medium that like then is further mediated through things like a soundboard at a concert in Boston or the recording equipment of a radio producer from WBAI, which is another interesting moment in the archive of that tour. Anyway, the book ends up thinking about sound in Marlon Riggs's documentaries and also at David Wojnarowicz's audio diaries. And specifically, I zero in on this moment in his audio diary where he's driving across the desert in New Mexico and hears Tracy Chapman's Fast Car come on the radio. Now newsworthy again. Yes. I can't even believe it. So he hears Fast Car come on the radio. He hits record on his tape recorder and he kind of duets with the song. He speaks around and in between Chapman's lines for most of the song. And it's just this really poignant bit of tape that I then do my own transcription of and reading of toward the end of the book, thinking about intergenerational listening and listening on behalf of one's ancestors and listening to one's ancestors. And this all comes back as well to the Sweet Honey and the Rock song Breaths, which encourages its listeners to listen to voices, to sounds of the natural world and understand that as the ancestor's breath. And then I realized that that kind of close listening to the ancestors is in fact what it is to write a book about an archive of disappointment over the course of the 20th century. And it was very late in the game that I was like, oh shit, that's me. I'm listening.
Captain, wow. Tell him I'm gone. Wow. You tell him I'm gone. Wow.
Can I make a tiny personal sidebar about one of my other moments of political disappointment when John Kerry did not win and I was in downtown Boston, and if he was going to win, Bon Jovi was supposed to come on and play. And so it was midnight and I was like freezing waiting for Bon Jovi to come on.
Oh man.
And Kerry did not win. And I was trying to remember, I mostly just remember being so cold, but I can't remember whether he came on and played. I was like,
he must not have, otherwise you would have remembered.
I think so.
Or we're dealing with some kind of trauma here that involves,
I know, I've literally repressed the, but yeah, so my electoral political disappointment figured in the receding or in the absence of.
What would Bon Jovi play to like either commemorate?
Living on a Prayer, right?
You should be living on a prayer.
I mean, not Wanted Dead or Alive.
Yeah, but like on like a, in a minor key, like a dirge Living on a Prayer.
But he was supposed to be there for.
I know he's there supposed to be there for.
As a celebration.
But if he did come out.
So like, what would he have, what could he have played in the event of a defeat?
Minor key Living on a Prayer, maybe, is the one that
we're halfway there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the best disappointed song ever. We're only halfway there.
Yeah. Yeah. Or slightly less than halfway there.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as it's not this sort of Zeno's paradox asymptotic situation, I think we're okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that that moment just arrived in my mind.
That's great. And now I want to connect what feels like a linked scene for me. And maybe it's the scene of, maybe it's the explanation for why I managed to never be super invested in any election. And it's because when Clinton won for the first time in 92.
Thereby ruining Fleetwood Mac forever.
Well, ruining Fleetwood Mac cannot be ruined.
No,
they
I
are
actually
resilient.
Love Fleetwood Mac, but that one Fleetwood Mac
even
song.
That song I have come back around to. It did take a while. Peter, Paul, and Mary played in a tent on the National Mall, and I went with my friends. Aww. And we saw Peter, Paul, and Mary play in a tent on the National Mall. And it felt great, but it was like, I knew at the age of, I was 14, and I was like, yeah, we're borrowing hope from the past.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And it's sort of moving, but it is not up to date.
You inoculated yourself against nostalgia at the age of 14 with the help of Peter, Paul, and Mary. That's an incredible story.
No amount of clapping is going to bring Puff the Magic Dragon back. It's just, no.
Oh, shit. Okay. okay, so I want to talk about the coda to the book and see where it can... I won't use the word hope, right? We've foreclosed that, but maybe we can see what the coda opens onto. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that you did the bulk of the work on the manuscript before 2020.
That's true.
That's right. Okay.
That's true.
But the coda was written just before publication. So it's quite recent.
Yes. Yes. The coda was written when exactly? I don't know. Definitely after Biden had taken office for sure.
And so as you write in that coda, events subsequent to the manuscript's completion left you in this place where, and I'm quoting, the element of disappointment that maintains faith in a future window of possibility started to feel like a relic of the past, close quote. Mm-hmm. And that's not where you leave things. We will certainly encourage listeners to buy the book to see, among other things, where you do end up. But I thought maybe we could talk in the terms of disappointment, or using what your account of disappointment makes possible, a little bit about our present moment, political or otherwise, however you want to hear that. So how do you feel about disappointment now?
Deep sigh. I mean, I almost want to start by saying that, like, how I feel about disappointment isn't the point. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to think, well, what question would make sense for understanding the purchase that the work I did in this book over the second Obama administration, the Trump administration, you know, finishing it up just in the early, early days of Biden's first term. Here we are in a moment that's both different from all those periods and yet very much growing out of them. I could say, what would I write now if I were going to write another coda? But I also just want to say, like, how is disappointment, what does disappointment as an analytic get us here in 2024? What good does it do us? That's what I want to think about more than, like, how do I feel about it? Mm. As I've gone around thinking about the book in public and discussing it with people over the past, let's say, 6 months or so, One of the aspects of it that has really come to the fore is this aspect of the long lineage and the long timeline and the understanding of dynamics as not pertaining only to the immediate present moment, but being in some ways returns and reworkings of much wider patterns and broader repetitions. What I want to avoid is that giving rise onto some sort of like quietist outlook where you're, you know, maybe you're in like a horrible, like effective altruism, like long, long time scale thing where nothing that you do this year or this decade has any appreciable effect at all. And you should really just be, you know, colonizing Mars or something. And that's not what I want to get out of this. But I do think that understanding a sort of commonality across history can at least forestall a little bit of what otherwise might, for some, maybe me including, come up as a kind of like panic that everything is coming apart in an immediate and irrevocable way. To understand, I'm really having trouble with this because like the present is tough, man.
Yeah.
Like the present is fucking tough. And that's one reason that I deal with it by looking to the past and finding elements of history that feel like they resonate with the present tense. There's a reason that I'm not, you know, out there writing like up to the minute think pieces for leftist magazines all the time. And it's in part, it's because I don't trust myself to be right about anything happening now. But I hope that I can pull out and identify and shine light on a wider archive of histories and expressions that can give us some context for understanding what's going on now.
I guess one of the things that strikes me, and again, I'm trying to sort of rigorously avoid the formulation that like on the other side of disappointment is hope, because I don't think you're saying anything that's quite so that's
God forbid.
Yeah, right. But also what I want to say is two things. Is disappointment is not despair.
Correct.
Disappointment is not despair. And that seems to be important when we think about what use this analytic has right now. Because Patrick was talking about dynamism. I would guess despair is about grinding to a halt.
Yes.
And there is a halting that happens here. But one thing that I find really, really helpful about your distinction between disappointment and disillusionment, it's not just the part of like, well, you weren't wrong, right? You're not recanting. It's, and here we get into the psychoanalytic language again, is you're still attached to the object.
Yes.
Like you're not talking entirely about loss of faith. It's not a theological. It's not a, you know, there's no sort of like, well, I thought that John Fetterman was the Messiah, but then I found out what he thought about Israel. Yeah. You know, it's not that sort of distinction. Like let's go in a way that's, this isn't quite utopian, but like for a lot of people on the left, political disappointment in the way that you're talking about probably has something to do with Bernie and their relationship to the Bernie Sanders campaign as this site of just enormous hope.
Yes, and I did. The Nation ran a review of my book, and thereafter I made a small tour of leftist podcasts and YouTube TV shows. Mm-hmm. And I learned just how alive that Bernie feeling is for so many.
Yeah. But I think what you're saying here, if I'm reading you correctly, is like attachment to the object, like that continued attachment to the object is like, that's part of this model.
Right. I think I write about it in the book as I say, like to have ongoing desire in the wake of a disappointment is proof of survival.
Yes.
Like you still want the thing that's not worth everything, but it's not worth nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that feels like something I can hold on to.
I think I want to second that. I hear you simultaneously reckoning with the stakes of the book and the question of like, how can we understand political agency and the vicissitudes of where fantasy and earnest grounded effort meet the reality principle or contingency or just the shit of life, right? But I also hear you asking, like, to what extent is the analytic that I've developed sketching out this thing even relevant to this moment? And I feel you on that level insofar as that, like, perhaps like a basic condition of creativity and writing in the world is somehow feeling that you're out of step with it in some way. But right, and also I can understand how that question may ramify to you in terms of, like, well, like, some desperate part of all of us is probably asking, is what do we not need now more than, like, I don't know, like something that's half PDM, like half like DSM, half like road novel, and half like how do you adapt through psychotic normality, right? Or like or a big treatise on like disavowal and lying, or you know what I mean? All the other things. But like what I actually think is that those are idealized desires, but also, and this is to echo what Abby is saying, is that the book that you did write and the model that you give us in terms of its relation to objects and relations to mourning, and in terms of the way basically it proposes an integrated vision of relationship to both your own agency and to the world, is a model of what you could call a sustainable mental health, if we want to call it that, right? This is at least a, or perhaps it envisages a subject that is capable of historical action, trauma even, and also of undergoing disappointment, but which endures relationally and is attached to objects. And in that sense, it gives us an idea of what a good working model for like an adaptive approach to our own politics might entail, at least for terms of like regulating ourselves, but also in terms of staving off bad options, right? Where we look for hope as a transaction, where we invest in an impossible outcome, where we give up and withdraw into some sort of depressive state. Like I think it really is.
Yeah, you went to depression. Yeah. I went to despair. Yeah. But well, I think both of us are reading this as something that's different.
What it feels like you give us is a model of like good enough political subjectivity.
Yeah, yeah, I like that so much as a formulation.
I think that's magnificent. I'm so glad you saw that there. I think you're right, and I think it's interesting that my aphasia, when you initially asked me, my mind was, how does disappointment solve the conflict in Gaza, for example? How does disappointment heal the absolutely shredded coalitions and alliances in US politics right now, or save the thousands of children who are starving to death? And that sent me into a sort of like despairy paralysis, like in real time on the podcast. Yeah. And what I love, Abby and Patrick, is that you brought it back to, well, it's a concept about a good enough political subjectivity, which is what you're saying. And once you said that, I then remembered what I have to say for what I think, like, I think disappointment could solve the fractured coalitions and alliances in the US left and save the thousands of children who are dying of starvation, which is that, like, being attached to an object that you can't have, or that you can't have the way that you want, or that you got and wasn't what you thought it would be, is in fact a shared experience across the people who are trying to destroy each other right now. And I really, I have no power to say, please go read my book and understand and find commonality in your non-fulfillment. I can't do that. And maybe it's the grief of seeing how impractical that is when it matters the most. But I still believe that it's the inability or the refusal, let's say, to recognize that is causing all this destruction.
Patrick, you're glossing Sarah's concept itself as being out of step in some way, like a desire or the untimeliness of desire. And it seems to me that the musicality of this, and I mean that in, you know, I mean, this whole book, it's structured, you know, it doesn't exist without all the work that you're doing with music. And the phrase that kept coming to my head is like out of step, but not out of tune. Do you know what I mean? That like there is this sort of like the political disappointment is something that actually attunes you to others that are experiencing that. And that has to do, I think, with some modes of relation that are, you know, to kind of use Patrick's developmental metaphor there, like that are mature.
And actually mature too in terms of how it involves, like, and here's how I'm thinking about, like, in a time of madness, having a working model for what some kind of sanity looks like, even, you know, sometimes basic sanity, and I'm using all these terms with, you know, sufficient caveats, can be like regulatory and clarifying for asking things like, well, I don't know, like, and I'm thinking of it specifically because of what Abby's saying about maturity, but I think about people who, like, whose political key right now is talking about, like, their either they still believe in the existence of, or are kind of like bemoaning the supposed passing of an idealized object, like, I don't know, the rules-based international order, or like institutional legitimacy, or the impartiality of the Supreme Court, right? Mm-hmm. And like from what I, from using your model, I'm like, oh, these people are hung up on either a utopian thing which will never happen, or on denying a certain other thing through getting fixated on this sort of static fiction. Right, that in any event, it's they're attempting to insulate themselves from some kind of pain or from some sort of need for the political.
Right,
and I think that is something that at least as a test we can impose on ourselves seems useful as we think through whatever it might be the values or programs that get us through any of these numbers of situations that are in front of us. Right, and likewise too, like I think it's the relational component. Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. Like another, I think there's Freud's account of mourning, melancholy is like really complicated and weird. I don't think there's a lot to, there's some things I don't think can be recuperated from it. But one thing is, I think, an idea at least, which is of a type of grief that shuts itself off from others.
Yes.
And a type of grief that shuts itself off from others because of either the fact or the conviction that the lost object is not an object whose loss is shared by others. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
But if your theory of political disappointment, as I think it does, extends to the implication that a mature relationship to the political means that your political object is always going to be on some level structurally disappointing, right? Mm-hmm, or involved you tarrying with the disappointment as a structural matter, then everybody is sort of always already in a position of having a common object in their disappointment. And that could be a vector for solidarity. I mean, what that, I mean, practically, I don't know, but I think that's what I take your... What I guess I'm saying is I don't see myself as saying anything that you don't already say in your text. And I think that just to speak to the despair that you voiced earlier, and I think that a lot of people in the world are feeling also in their own individual ways, right? Is that if one of the lessons of your book and one of the themes of your book is like listening to ancestors and listening to voices and their sort of concatenation, I think that is something that ramifies in terms of how we can listen to the untimeliness or actual timeliness of your book in its publication history, but also as giving us something across these chapters for thinking about how politics in general or our own relationship to politics isn't just disappointment in an object or disappointment in other people, but sometimes involves integrating disappointment in ourselves or the fear of disappointment in ourselves. And that actually we can have untimely opinions, dissonant opinions, opinions that come back later, and that we have to integrate those two in addition to those solid heuristic communal integrations.
One of the best antidotes to despair on a daily basis is the morning show on WFMU, which streams online. It has this incredible DJ named Clay Pigeon. The song is called Wake and the show is called Wake and Bake with Clay Pigeon. And he has an amazing taste in music, and he brings irrepressible enthusiasm every morning. And this, speaking of like nonverbal sonic carriers of feeling, every morning at 7:05, he intros a ridiculous, like, news of the weird news. Like, it's the news hour, but it has nothing to do with like real world events. And to start it, he yells, "Takatata," and he tells his listeners to say it with me. It'll bring you good luck. Takatata. And Roy and I will yell it in the house at 7:05, and it's sort of this like morning ritual, sonic ritual
of
clearing away the despair and starting the day. And also, just as I said, he plays incredible music, and there's this just like young kid in LA whose name is MK.GEE. I assume it's pronounced MKG. It sounds like he rebuilt the Fleetwood Mac studio that Fleetwood Mac built to record Tusk and put it on psilocybin and writes these like unbelievable pop songs with these just meaty, like rotund sounds. Like, I don't know how he's making the sounds he's making. They're so beautiful. So that's something that I've been just turning way up in the car lately. I really know almost nothing about him except he dropped out of USC to make music. And since I had a 1 year postdoc at USC and I had to leave it before the second year, I'm like, oh yeah, we're USC dropouts together.
Sarah, before we wind up, can you tell us about any upcoming writing, appearances, places where people can read you, hear you, et cetera?
Yeah, as far as like book promo stuff, the non-academic stuff was really last fall. And now I'm closing that out and starting to really focus on the next project. So this podcast is my big media appearance for the spring.
Well, we're honored.
It's a delight to have you.
I'm honored too. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you all so much for listening. We appreciate your support. If you could bring yourself to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening, we'd be grateful. Ordinary Unhappiness is entirely supported by our Patreon community. So if you can't get enough OU, or if you would like to help support our ongoing existence, we would be grateful if you would head on over to patreon.com/ordinaryunhappiness. Patreon supporters get 2 more episodes per month, 1 of the standard edition and 1 wild analysis where the wheels really come off and, the rubber hits the road, or whatever metaphors I'm mixing, but you all know what I'm saying. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week. This has been an episode of Ordinary Unhappiness, a podcast about psychoanalysis, politics, pop culture, and the ways we suffer now. I'm Abby Kluchin, and today I was joined by Patrick Blanchfield and Sarah Marcus. This podcast is produced by Dan Yowell. Theme music by Formal Chicken.